Hello, this is Deborah Anderson, the Black Woman Animator, coming back with another video. And in this video, I have Rodney Barnes. Welcome.
Thank you.
Can you introduce yourself?
I am a writer, producer of television and film, and a comic book creator.
All right, let's get started. So you're from the Eastport community of Annapolis, Maryland. How was it growing up?
For the most part, it was a good thing. I mean, I spent a lot of time by myself. I was raised in a single parent household. My mother was in graduate school when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I was raised on and off by my grandmother, and I spent a lot of time reading out in those streets, those hard Annapolis streets, with my friends. But, it was a good thing. I think, back during those times in the mid and late 70s, it was a time when I really built my imagination and good thoughts, good times.
What were some of your best childhood memories?
Movies, comic books, movies, just playing. I mean, I think I missed having a nuclear family. When my parents broke up, I missed the idea of family in the traditional sense of the word. Yeah. So I kind of filled that space and those emotions with my imagination and fun. And I think anytime I could find comic books and those types of things to sort of fill that void, that sort of did the trick. It made me feel not so lonely, not so alone.
Yeah. So, is it an exaggeration when you say you were 6 foot at like 6 or 7 years old?
It's a slight exaggeration. I mean, certainly by the time I got out of elementary school, I was 6 feet tall.
Because you were saying that that's how you used your height to be able to watch movies all day.
Well, no, when I was, and back then, I don't know if they just didn't care and they didn't check, but I could walk into a movie theater and see adult movies, not X-rated movies, but I could see, like, back then, they would have movies run, like now you have a movie run, if it's not successful, a movie will be out of a theater in a week or so. But I remember movies like Apocalypse Now or The Exorcist or, like, hit movies would be in the movie theater for months. And I could just walk in as a kid and see an R-rated movie, like, and just walk in, just buy a ticket and walk in. And nobody checked an ID or anything like that. And so I saw a lot of stuff that I probably shouldn't have seen. Blaxploitation movies, because they would run again and again and again. They wouldn't just run and then go. They would come back over and over and over again. So I saw all of that stuff. And a lot of times when I do, like, I just did a Blackula book for my own company. And a lot of times my love for pop culture and blaxploitation comes from I ate up so much of that stuff as a kid because I saw it over and over and over again. So, yeah.
And here I was when I went to college. I was 17 for a little bit, but I eventually turned 18. And I went to a rated R movie. I felt like the woman wanted to card me for the rated R movie. I was like, I looked so young. I was like, but I'm 18 though. I can go see this movie.
You still look young.
Yes, I do. I look young.
I would card you right now.
Yes, I look 10 to 15 years younger than I actually am. My only goal from 30 was to keep the same face to 40, and so I'm over halfway there. Luckily, I didn't keep the same hair because there's a lot of gray hair that you cannot see.
I can't see. It's that water. Yeah. It's drinking all that water.
Yes, drinking all that water. That's the secret, people. That is the secret.
Yes.
And not letting people stress you out.
Well, I failed on that one.
So, what is your cultural makeup? And that's not to only say what's your ethnicity, but what is the culture of where you grew up and the uniqueness of where you're from?
Annapolis, Maryland is a slave port, or was a slave port. And it has a very unique math. I think psychologically, There's not a real infrastructure for African American culture, but we created one nonetheless. And that math sort of is deeply embedded in my psyche. So I still feel deeply connected to that period of the 70s, the civil rights movement, the struggle. I'm sort of like a religion is deeply embedded in me. Even though we're so far, we're in a post-Obama world, my mind and emotions are still sort of centered in that. I may be writing a movie about Gil Scott-Heron. And so I'm anytime a studio or a company or even in my own work, I get an opportunity to write about the 60s or the 70s. I'm drawn, and in the early 80s, I'm drawn to that period because it's one that emotionally I'm sort of connected to because of my hometown. Those were my formative years. I read a lot about the Panthers. When my mother was in grad school, she was reading all of those books and would leave them laying around. So, Soul on Ice, Revolutionary Suicide, Dick Gregory's books, like all of that stuff as a little kid, I was reading. And like I didn't completely understand it because I was a kid, but some of the broad beats I understood. And the world was different then in the sense of now you have to seek out information in a different kind of way. But during that period of time, comedians were talking about politics, the
Dick
music was talking
Gregory.
about, all of it. But you would have like the Phil Donahue show, Mike Douglas, Dick Cavett, late night TV, you would have Muhammad Ali might come on, or different people would come on and they would talk about whatever was happening in the world. It wasn't just about entertainment per se. Like politics sort of permeated every aspect of life. And so you were inundated with Earth, Wind and Fire, Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, and all of this. You were inundated with this idea of what was happening in the culture. And that sort of thinking, when you ask me about, ethnicity, psychologically, that sort of, even when you talk about spirituality or religion or all of that, that sort of is the through line of my life and probably will be there until I die.
Because even me growing up, I didn't realize how targeted my father was. Because I used to be like, why was I reading Native Son in eighth grade? Like, and then I'm like, oh, my dad did that on purpose. Like, once I was in my 20s, I was like, oh, okay. And he infiltrated my mind. Okay.
You were being
Positively.
indoctrinated. You're
Right.
being
Yes,
indoctrinated
yes,
in the
yes.
way of
Th
thinking.
that is the word. And so I was like, oh, okay, I got it. And the perspective came when like I was asking him to buy, like before I moved to LA, I asked him to buy me the book set from Claude Anderson, like Powernomics and stuff like that. And he was like, oh, you didn't read that yet? I had your nieces read this. I was like, so you're indoctrinating them too. Okay, got it. And then like, to speak of, like I know we lived in for to be Black Americans, we live in a a more privileged society, but still, like my dad calls me Angela Davis. So even as I was watching like Kindred, I for me myself personally, I just was like, let me read the book, because for me Kindred, I didn't like the TV show, and I was like, ain't no way people been talking about Octavia Butler being awesome, and this is what it is. So that's when I listened to the book. I was like, okay, yes, the book. Yes. And then I was talking to my friends like, yeah, because in the TV show you could tell they's trying to center the white people. Octavia Butler was not trying to center the white people in her book. Like, so I still be on the Angela Davis like Black Power, even though I live in California. What would you say your favorite like tradition from growing up, like family custom tradition that you have from growing up?
That's a really good question. It's harder because as you get older, the things that those things sort of don't, they fall away. It's harder to get younger people to sort of I grew up on the East Coast and now I'm on the West Coast, and West Coast life is so different than East Coast life. Even for simple things, because the seasons, you know, it doesn't get cold here in the same way as it did there. Things you don't think about. I mean, I don't know the answer to the question. I mean, I think it's probably the rhythm of my life and how I go about, like, at certain periods during the fall, I read more. I have a tendency to, the rhythm of my life works. I know at certain periods of the year I'm going to be doing certain things. Like, because my profession, because I'm a writer, there's the regular 9 to 5 and what I do, even though it doesn't work like 9 to 5. But I know at certain periods of the year, even though the weather is typically the same, in the fall, in the winter, I'm going to be behaving the way I have behaved traditionally. I'm going to be reading more. I'm going to be looking for certain material more at a certain time of the year, as I have for the better part of my life. That's probably the closest thing. I don't really have like the holiday traditions and those types of things. Not as much because that aspect of family doesn't exist anymore. You know, and my kids have gotten to an age where, for the most part, they've aged out of the little kid things in the same way that they used to. So, you know.
Okay, so you went to Howard University. Was going to HBCU purposeful for you, and how's your experience going to HBCU?
It was great. I actually went to Bowie State first,
Okay.
because my mother went to Bowie. That's where she got her graduate and undergraduate degree. Yes, it was purposeful because I knew that by the time I got to Howard, I knew what I wanted to be. I knew I wanted to be a writer. I knew I wanted to make movies and TV shows. And I knew that a lot of people who looked like me had gone to Howard and done that thing. And I remember talking to Spike Lee at Crown Books in Upper Marlboro one day, and he encouraged me to go to Howard. He had written a book called X that was a companion book to the Malcolm X movie that he made. It was him and Ralph Wiley. And I snuck off from work one day to go get my book signed. I bought the book and he was going to sign it. And I ended up standing next to him for 3 hours and he just talked to me and was encouraging me. He was like, "Brother, what are you doing now?" And I had stopped going to school once I realized I wasn't going to be an athlete and I wasn't good enough. And he said, like, "What are you doing with yourself, brother? You need to go back to school. You're working at no store. You're smarter than that. I hear it in your voice." And he's like, "There's a reason that you're here, and it's not just to be a fan of me." And he said, "You need to get back in school. You need to do something with yourself." And I understood what he said, and I was happy to hear the words, but I didn't completely believe in me enough to make that jump. But there was something about being around my own people and being in a safe space that made me feel a little bit more comfortable with the idea of taking a shot at it. And hearing one of my heroes, then and now, sort of encouraging me helped. And then going to Howard and, you know, having a lot of students. I was a little older than everybody else at the time, but it was, that never really got in the way. And it was purposeful, and I'm glad I made that decision, and it's a great institution.
You had the situation where you were told to come to LA, and then somebody didn't follow through on their promise. So like what was the culture shock of coming from Annapolis to LA, that was different from what you were used to growing up in Maryland?
the pace. The two things that happen, and both have to do with the business. When you cut, when you live in a place your whole life, you know every aspect of it. And psychologically, I knew how to survive in Maryland and in Annapolis. Like, I knew how to get a job, I knew where to go. And we're talking about basic survival existence, putting food in my stomach and a roof over my head. I'm not excuse me, we're not talking about success. We're talking about just basic survival. I did not know that in LA, because you have more people, it moves faster, and everybody's trying to do the same thing. And I don't know who's, I don't know who's telling me the truth. I don't know the rhythm. I don't know the hustle. I don't know the game. I don't know any of that.
Right.
And it moves so fast. When you come from Annapolis, is a small town with small town thinking and small town ideas for the most part. And you come here and everybody has star thinking and everybody has big dreams and big ideas and everybody's going to be a success story overnight, and et cetera, et cetera. Making the adjustment, not just psychologically, but emotionally, is intimidating and terrifying and all of that. It took a minute to make that adjustment. And even to this day, sometimes I hear my older ideas and thinkings and all of that, and I have to move it to the side. And, you know, it's not easy.
Yeah. Like, even getting this apartment that I'm in now, like, I came to visit it. The dude was like, okay, fill out the application. Where I was staying was 5 minutes away. And then I went to fill out the application, and it was giving me trouble. And he was like, oh, somebody else swiped it up. I'm like, yep. I drove 5 minutes.
He didn't care about that. He didn't care about that at all.
That's just the pace. I was just like, dang, like, I couldn't even, hey, okay, all right. So like in other cities, you can very much just be like, I'll think about it. Like, not in LA.
No.
you better know what you
snooze
want.
You lose. Yes, yeah, snooze, you lose.
Were your parents supportive of your artistic interests?
No, nobody believed in this. My grandmother told me, I think even before she, no one knew or nor understood what it is that I do. I think it was, my grandmother wanted me to get a good job with benefits, and I think all the way till the end. And I don't think the idea of not, I don't think anyone looked at it as a job or a career, because it doesn't have any, it's almost like being in the circus. You know, unless you're on a hit TV show, every 3 months or so, you're unemployed.
Right.
And even when I have friends who want me to help their kids or who want to be in the business, they don't understand, like, all right, so you're going to give them a job, right? I was like, I ain't got no job to give nobody. It's like,
exactly.
So wait a minute. So, all right, so my kid comes out there, right? And even if I can give them a job as a PA or something like that, so how long that's like, then what do they do? But then they got to find another job. Well, where? Well, wherever they find another job. So what if they don't find a job? Well, what'd you do? I lived in my car. I ain't letting my baby live in no car. And then they're mad at me. And I'm like, well, I didn't create this system. And I'm like, but this is how it is.
Right.
And they think somehow I have, you don't live like that. It's like, but I did live like that. I lived like that for a long time. Like, for, I didn't immediately jump from this guy to the guy that, you know, it took a minute for me to find some traction.
Right.
And I think a lot of times that's the obstacle for a lot of people, is they don't want to go through that period of difficulty.
Right.
Of uncertainty, of hurt, of pain, that weeds out a lot of people who don't want to go through that or can't emotionally go through that. Mm-hmm. And I certainly think as a generation right now, folk who, that's not the vision that they had in their heads of Hollywood and success, all of that, because it's hard. And the problem is, once you get into it, you realize everybody wants what you want.
And there's a lot of people that's better.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. And better is a relative term. You know, it's such a subjective thing of what's better, and then finding traction as to, you know, all right, you might get a job. And I know a lot of people who got a gig, worked a couple of years, and then never worked again. And guys who I looked up to, people who I looked up to. And I know some people who I think are as good as me or better who are struggling to get in the game. I know people who I may have a couple of skills that they don't, who are at the top of the field. It's like it's a weird kind of, you know, is it luck? Is it this? Is it what is it? You know, there's so many intangibles that I can't write a book and say, do this, do that, and you're in, and it's all going to be great. There are no rules. And I think that's the maddening part of it. You know, you can schmooze your way through, you can party, you can network, you can do all of those things that they tell you in books and seminars, but it'll only get you so far because you have to be able to do the thing. That's the foundation of it, which is write. If you want to be a writer, you have to be able to write. But then there's so many other things that they don't tell you about in school. Like school can say interior, exterior, and all of the rules of writing and all of that. But then you get here and there's so much other stuff that you have to learn how to do in order to be able to survive here. And those are the skills that you really have to learn through heartache and pain and struggle. And none of those words are sexy. And none of those words feel good. And nobody wants to hear those words. And they're hoping sometimes when I have these types of conversations that I can say something that will circumvent that path. And little do they know, I have to endure that every day. Like there's me, you and I having this conversation right now for the 20 times over the past 25 years that someone has said yes. Not the 1,000 times that people have said no. I hear no so many times. Or I hear yes and then no. You know, like I thought it was yes. And then a couple of days later, you know what, second thought, no. Or I work
Or
for.
yes, and then the no comes from them not responding.
That, well, yes, I thought it was yes. It was kind of. It really wasn't yes. Or I have to work for free for so long and then get nothing for that. Like I have a board right now, if I could turn this computer around with 50 things on it. Three might happen. Might. And I have to live with the reality of. They're going to get shot down. They're going to die. I have to take it and I have to keep moving. And each one of them hurt. And I have to be, and that's the emotional thing that I wish college taught, you know, certainly for us. You know, when I say us, I'm talking about our people, you know, because I think sometimes we get sort of in a place where there's one part of the business that we get taught, but there's another part of the business that you have to be prepared for because the business doesn't prepare you for it. And you know, I'm trying to say it in a way that's specific in the sense of it's almost like there's an idealism sometimes that we're presented with, like you can do everything and it's going to be great and go for it and everything's going to work out your way. And I'm not saying it can't. I'm not saying that everybody can't have their dreams come true. Dreams can come true. My dream came true. And but getting to your dream, you got to go through something to get. There are some people who first time out, they hit the lottery and, you know, but I don't know those people. I don't know them. Most of the people that I know and whose names you may know, the famous people, by the time they become famous, they've gone through something. They have worked nights, they've had their hearts broken, they have like a shield in front of them because they've gone through so much that, you know, whoever, you name it. You name who, whatever name that's popping up in your head right now, they've gone through something to get to where they are. And you only know it until you get there. And me, I'll say for me, before I got to a place where I was having this conversation with you, I thought it was one thing until I got in it and I said, oh, okay, Now I understand. If you talk to me in 1998, 99, you talk to that guy versus the guy that I am today, that guy was an idiot by comparison. Because I thought I knew, because it seems obvious. It's like, oh, okay, if you're a good writer, you get a job. Like anything, it's a meritocracy. It's not just a meritocracy. It's not. It's a so many other things.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if that helps anybody out there, but if you can... If you can be tough enough to wade through a massive amount of disappointment and continuously rediscover your dream and continue to ask yourself, it's like dealing with a bad kid. Like if you got a bad kid, your own child that you love to death, but he keeps getting arrested. And you love this kid. And every time he gets arrested, you're like, damn, you know, why do I keep bailing his ass out? I should leave him in jail, but no, I really, really love him. I have faith. I pray for him every night. You want to leave him in jail, but you love him and you have faith in him. And then that last time he comes to you and it's like, Dad, I get it. And he goes on and he has a good life. That's sort of like what having a career in Hollywood is. You got to go through so much disappointment. And then one day, right when you least expect it, a door opens and things sort of work out. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, I, you know, with my platform, I have people reach out to me for advice, and then I, you know, give them the advice, and then they kind of debate you back and forth, like, do you want the advice or no? Because, like, you don't got to take it, but this is what I'm telling you. Why are you coming to the expert if you're not going to listen? Like, what was the point? You could have just kept thinking you knew everything if you was going to debate me back and forth. Like, I'm trying to told you.
Exactly. And it's almost like when people ask you, it's almost like when people ask me to read a script. I hate when people ask me to read a script because they're asking me because they want me to like the script. They really, and if I don't like the script, they want me to fix the script. I don't have time to read it in the first place because I'm too busy trying to write my own.
Right.
And fixing the script is like a job, you know, it's like, it's your script. You gotta, you know, do the thing.
Right. But
I get that request at least 4 or 5 times a week of, you know, read my script. It's great. Well, it's great. You don't need me to read it, you know, get somebody that can give it, you know, take it to a studio. They can do it for you. But I have empathy for people because it's such a nebulous field. It doesn't have rules. It doesn't have walls. It doesn't have like
steps. Like step one, like, step two, step three.
Yeah, like a regular, like you usually when you go into a Walmart, there's a place you can go to get an application. You fill out an application, they tell you where a job, like it's a job board, and this is what's available, and you can go in and, you know, like you said, you get, there's a department manager thing, and you know exactly how you move up in the game. Here, you have to get in it first, and then everybody's going to lie to you. You're very good at that part.
Yes.
Can't tell who's lying because they're so good. And I've had times where I had people lie to me, and they lied to me so good that I was actually being fired, but I thought I was being promoted. Like, I walked out happy. Like, I thought I was getting something. But
that's
I was
some
actually
expertise.
Losing something. It's incredible. It's like I actually, and it for a minute, it actually tainted, like, my, I became cynical. Like, I had a period, where a dark period of, I don't like this. Like, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. And I had a angry period of, I'm not happy. And then it got to a place where, you know, during that evolution of what do I want to be, you know, but it's all in the evolution of a career, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just wish it had more structure to it.
So. Yeah, one of my previous jobs, I had like a supervisor that ran the department and then a boss that signed our checks. And sometimes, like, I could tell both of them was lying to me. But the boss did it in a more professional, like, believable way. So I would actually go ask him questions. Like, I just stopped going to my supervisor because I'm like, that's what you thought of? That's the lie you thought of? So I would go to the more palpable lie. So this is the part where I list some of your projects. I'm not gonna list everyone, but I'll list the animation ones and then some of the prominent live action. So for animation, you're the head writer and executive producer for Boondocks, co-executive producer on Legends of Chamberlain Heights. You were developing an animated Vandavion and Mike.
Vandavion and Mike, yeah.
Vandavion. I was like, dang,
Was
what's
a
the wrong
long
way to say
time
that?
ago.
I had it yesterday, but not today. It was like I can't read. And so live action, you were a production assistant on Major Payne, set production assistant on Blade, set security on Rush Hour, executive assistant on Rush Hour 2, executive story editor, writer, producer on My Wife and Kids, writer, co-executive producer, supervising producer on Everybody Hates Chris. You're a writer on Def Comedy Jam 25, writer on American Gods, Wu-Tang American Saga, and most recently, Winning Time: The Rise of the Lakers Dynasty. So, what would you say is your biggest breakthrough in your career, or have you had multiple?
Breakthrough?
Yes.
And you mean recently?
Whatever a breakthrough is to you,
Being able to work regularly is sort of a breakthrough. I mean, I think I had a period where I had a period where when I was first doing sitcoms from 2000 to 2010, I was sort of stuck because I never really wanted to do sitcoms. That was like the job, that was my in. That was my way into the business. And I was grateful, and I am grateful because I really didn't know what I was doing. And it was a learning experience. It was kind of like going to college. I got an opportunity to be in a writer's room, to learn from people who knew more and were way more talented. And it was a great opportunity. But I knew I wanted to be doing, I wanted to tell different types of stories, and I thought my skill set lent itself to different types of storytelling, but I didn't know how to get there. And I had some challenges in my life that sort of created a bridge to getting there. And I worked on a show for HBO called Vinyl, and that was sort of a breakthrough in getting closer to telling the types of stories that I think I tell best. Because they're not just, they don't just have humor or drama, but it's sort of all of the facets of what I think I do. I'm using the stuff that I do best, if that makes sense, instead of one thing that I do okay, if that makes sense.
So what would you say? Because like sometimes I can see young people or people who are trying to get into the industry of like, I want to do this, so I'm only going to go for this,
No,
or
I have
even
that
like
too.
whether that's the type of writing or like you start as a production assistant. Some people are like, I'm trying to be a writer, so let me try to be a. And it's like, what if you start somewhere else, get in the studio, make connections, then? So, what are your thoughts on that?
I was a PA for 5, 6 years, and it was a very valuable. It's the same thing I said about being on sitcoms for a decade. I needed to learn. I needed to know what I didn't know. So the opportunity, when we were talking a moment ago about all of the other stuff that goes around the job that you don't know, I got an opportunity to learn how people think, how people act, how people, the psychology of Hollywood. And I still made massive mistakes. It's a miracle that you want to talk to me today with all of the mistakes that I've made and continue to make from time to time. That, but I had an opportunity to get around the business and understand the business from there's what you think you know, And then there's what you learn once you're in it, because it's not what you think from what you see on TV. It's not what you hear on gossip, you know, whatever. It is still people at the end of the day. And it has its own ecosystem. It moves at its own pace. It does its own thing. It's the same thing with writing. You can write anything on paper, but not anything can be made. Writing a producible script is different than just writing a script. They're different things. And you only know that if you're writing things that can that have been produced. I can read a script and tell the difference between someone who has been produced and someone who's just writing incredible words, but words that have actually actors have said them and cameras have shot them. They're different things. And so can studios. You know, you can tell the difference between potential and you know, someone who is actually experienced. So I would say any opportunity is an opportunity. There are some people who are savants that can get in the game and, you know, just shoot to the top. Again, I ain't never met that person. I never met them. I'm sure they exist though. So there could be that one person that said, I heard Rodney Barnes that time, you know, he told her that you need to be a PA. And I wasn't a PA and I became a billionaire. I wasn't talking about you, bro. I was talking about everybody else that needed to learn the stuff that they don't teach you in school that ultimately will save you once you get in the business. That has nothing to do with writing and everything to do with surviving in a business environment. Because that's really what it is. You're in an environment where you're working with people, oftentimes in a highly stressed environment where everything's on the line, where people sometimes aren't being their best selves because they're anxious and everything's on the line, and you want to be treated like with all of this respect and all of this stuff that we get in a regular in the real world, and you're dealing with people who have a gun to their heads, who feel like if I don't get this, if I don't perform this at the top of whatever, my career is over. Oh my God. And then they snap at you in a moment, and they may treat you in a particular way, and it's not personal, but you know, in that moment, and I'm not advocating anybody treating anybody poorly, but being able to know the difference between somebody who's under duress is somebody who's just an asshole. It's like, and being able to develop the wherewithal to tell the difference, you know, and a thicker skin and a this and a that and whatever. And sometimes it's just about being able to be in an environment and just tell how this environment works. And sometimes to be able to tell the difference between an environment that you can tolerate and one that you can't. There are environments that are abusive that you don't want to be a part of. And there are environments that are just difficult because of the nature of the work. And those are different things. And you don't know that if you just look at one and you think this is all of them that they're, and no, I've been on a at least 40, 50 shows, I guess, in the course of my life, and a dozen movies, or however many. Every one of them is different. Every single one of them is different. And if you look at one, and I thought, because I was on my wife and kids, I worked on my wife and kids almost 5, 6 years, whatever. I thought every show worked like that. And then I got to the next one, it was completely different. I got to the next one, it was completely different. And after a while, you just go, okay, what am I walking into? And sometimes I'm creating the environment. And sometimes I'm a part of the environment. And sometimes I'm just a fly on the wall. It's according to, you know, where you are on the totem pole. And, you know, it's so many different variables, but you don't know that if all you know is what you think you know when you walk in the door.
I can definitely see the benefit of learning all the muck and the mire, like in something that you don't necessarily want to do. So when you do your dream, then you know. Because if you do your dream immediately, then that might shoo you away from your dream. So to learn as a production assistant what everything is, and then once you become a writer, you have a little bearing on it, and now you can do your dream and not be, oh man, like I thought this was gonna be something different. when it's not actually the writing, it's the environment. And so, yeah, I can see the benefit of learning all that in something you don't really care about.
Sometimes getting what you want right out of the box can be the worst thing.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Again, I'm not talking about that brilliant dude that I wish I was.
But like to speak on that, I've brought this up a couple times in interviews, but there's a guy, Stevie Mackey. He's a vocal coach. He's like the voice coach for J-Lo and people. And I remember I was watching a YouTube video where he was on somebody's show, and he was talking about, you know, when we look at a masterpiece, if we look at a Monet or a Picasso, if we have them stand right next to us, they can point out every mistake, but we still consider them a masterpiece. So, like, do mistakes matter? Sometimes they
And
don't.
what's a mistake?
And then there's the like, did you hear like Stevie Wonder? One of his popular songs came out decades ago, and then in the past 5 years, he was listening to it like, did y'all hear that? And then it was like a missed note, and like, what? What? But it's still a Stevie Wonder song, and everybody loves it. So, what is the difference between writing for live action animation and comic books for you?
Nothing. It's all story for me. I approach it all the same, which is unfortunate because you get paid different money for all of them. It's like it's all story. It's sometimes the pacing is different, or but it's all story. I don't really have a, I don't differentiate. When people ask that question, and sometimes they ask it differently, they'll talk about like genres. They'll say horror, comedy, drama, you know, whatever. They're asking from that point of view. And I'm like, I don't really look at it differently because it's all characters doing character-driven things. They're all doing different things, but it's still people doing things. Whether it's satirical in the sense of satirical in the sense of the Boondocks, or if it's a family comedy like Everybody Hates Chris or Wife and Kids, they still all have objectives and they all still have an agenda and a goal. But in some senses, you know, some may be funny, some they may do it in a funny way, or they may do it in a way that's horrifying if you're talking about American Gods or what have you.
I know something you had mentioned was like, at least for comic books, not writing what's on a panel. And like, because the drawing is telling that, so write something different.
You said, well, say it one more time.
For comic books, you had mentioned in on a talk somewhere, like you had to learn if the panel, if the drawing is doing something, don't write that.
I was saying that I have a tendency, I had a tendency in the beginning to write my story like I was writing a movie or a TV show, not taking, like when you're writing a movie or a TV show, you're sort of influencing the direction. But when you're dealing with art, you just have a panel. You just have a flat piece of art that you're dealing with. And that does a significant amount of the work, and you have to work with it in a different way instead of allowing it to do the work like you're filming something that's moving constantly. So in this case, I have to use less words. Like you don't see the words on a TV show. You hear actors say the words. So you're not even, a lot of times people ask me, they don't even understand that writers write words on TV shows sometimes. They think that people just get up and start talking. Like my grandmother, when I told her I wrote TV, she looked at me like, they're just talking. We write words. Like, what are you talking about? She didn't understand that. And in comic books, you see the words, but the words have to support it in such a way that you want less words. So you want to see the art, hopefully, if the art is good art. So I had to learn to say more with less in order to be able to support the art, and then do it in such a way that pace-wise, especially if you've got a great letterer, that it would, the way they're positioning the letters, that it's landing in such a way that it's making you get the most emotion on the page as possible. That's it.
When I saw you on the panel at CamCon, you were saying how you used Philadelphia to explore the relationship with your father. Can you talk more about that, and has it been healing for you?
Healings are an interesting word.
Mm-hmm.
It's been cathartic only in the sense of it's kind of like therapy in a way. I don't know if in my therapy there's healing. I think there's been better ways of dealing with things. I think if you get perspective, it doesn't affect you, and you don't personalize it as much when you get perspective. I'll say for me. Like in the beginning, if you have trauma, if I have trauma, you said, this happened to me. Man, this happened, something happened. When you get perspective, you have the opportunity to be able to have empathy for the other person. Because once you start writing about it, and if you're writing, if you're doing good quality writing, from my opinion, you approach the other character objectively. You don't approach the other character like a villain. Like Darth Vader's not a villain. Darth Vader is a Sith. And from the Sith point of view, they're just as justified as the Jedi. So if I'm writing this character, not from the place of a villain, even if I'm using him as sort of an example of the person that maybe in my prior thinking wronged me, I'm saying, okay, I'm being empathetic to this person. And maybe the person that did this thing that I didn't like when I was younger, maybe they were doing the best that they could do at that time. And if I can look at it from that point of view, I don't personalize it in the same way. And if I don't personalize it in the same way, I can remove my feelings from it a little bit. And if I can look at it from a macro place, I can say maybe that person was dealing with some stuff too. And maybe this was the best coming from the world that they came from and the sensibilities that they came from. And maybe if they could pull it back, they would have done it better or differently if they had had the better information and a better way of doing things. And maybe they were hurting as well. So if I continue to write from that place, I'm actually writing out forgiveness.
You also talked about on the panel, your daughter's kind of getting you to get more women characters. So what was that?
Yeah, they have a tendency. They're bullies. They're bullies. They're those girls. They're very bullied. They told me the other day, one of them had a disappointment, and they told me that it was my fault because I made their lives so good that I didn't prepare them for disappointments in life. And I was like, ain't that some shit? No one cared about disappointments in my life. Yes. They did, and that was good because it made me a. It's funny because when I was younger, I always came from young black boy perspective. Like, why wouldn't we have more black superheroes? But when I was saying that, I wasn't thinking about more black female superheroes. I was thinking about black men. Like, I was thinking about the Luke Cages and all of those people. I was thinking more like, why don't we have more black male Justice League or Avengers, characters? I wasn't thinking about women because I'm going from my group and I'm thinking about this from the point of view of a child. Now, I thought Storm was cool and Misty Knight was cool and those other characters were cool when they came along, but I wasn't as charged for them as unless they did something incredibly cool. As I was when you give me a bad brother that I identify with as a young man. But then when I thought about my daughters, I was able to put myself in their position because it was personal, because they're my daughters, and go, oh, I get it. I get how this affects you. You want to see you. And if you want to see you, there's a whole lot of yous that want to see you as well and want to feel a particular way and want to identify yourself in this world, not just this comic book world, but in the world world in a larger sense. And if I can do that, I'm not just doing it for my kid. I'm doing it for my culture in general, but the larger idea of the thing that I'm connected to. And so I put my daughter in it. Brittany is one of the characters in Killadelphia. But I also tried to not so much personalize it from just her, but from the idea of a lot of girls that she's connected to as well. So, and I also did another book, Nita Hall's Nightmare Blog, that is also connected to women as well. So, yeah, influence, high five to my bad kids.
After being a writer for a while, what made you want to start Zombie Love Studios when you did?
Because I was tired of waiting for people, tired of having to go to somebody when I had a idea. If I had an idea, here's the process. When you don't have your own thing, you get an idea and you go, all right, what am I going to do with this idea? When I first came to Hollywood, all the ideas I have now, or at least the ideas that people have been reading for the last 5 years, they've been around. There ain't nothing new. I had these for the past 25 years. I tried to do them as TV shows and movies, and nobody bought them. I had a couple of bites, and things got close, and they never got made. So I was like, all right, what do I do with this? And I ended up making them as comic books. And still, I had to go through the process that I went through with TV shows and movies where I had to go to ask somebody for permission. I had to go to someplace. And you got to explain. And you have to say, this is why this is important. And more often than not, I'm not talking to somebody who actually understands the nuance and specificity of the culture that I'm speaking to because they're not of that culture. And they don't understand the thing to get excited about because they're not from that thing. And it's nothing about, it's not a big monster like they're bad people or they're anything. It's not nefarious. It's not, I'm not saying anything bad about them. I'm just saying that they don't get it in the same way that I get it. So it's tiring to have to have to do the selling from a way that speaks to their sensibilities. And then I have to tell the story from that sensibility to entertain them when it's really more to entertain primarily my sensibility. It's the thing that you said about Kindred. Not, I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know, but I've heard people say what you said. Where you have to switch up a thing because you got to go through a gate in order to get it on the air. That, and sometimes that gate is manned by someone who wasn't necessarily of the same sensibilities as Octavia Butler. And they want to see it from a sensibility that they understand because they think if they understand it that way, that the audience is going to understand it that way. And because they represent the audience, not that sensibility. So that whole math, that whole frustration, that whole thing you got to jump through to get there, that becomes tiring after a while. And you don't want to do that. So I wanted to create something to where the things that were most dear to me, the stories that were, and all of them are dear to me, but they're like four or five to where I know these require nuance in a way that I can't really shave edges off. I can't really play with. I have to tell them right down the middle. I can tell them the way that I want to tell them. All I got to do is come up with the money to be able to tell them. And that's why I created a company. That's why I did it the way that I wanted to do it. It's hard. It's hard to because you got to do everything. It's not, it's hard in general, but it's hard when you run a production company, when you got a TV show, when you're trying to get movies going, when you're trying to live a life, when you got all kinds of other stuff, when you're getting older, when you got these badass kids that won't stop getting bad and that are spoiled as hell. When you have all of these other things and you're a giant, you have all of these things that you have to deal with in life, and you have to stop and deal with the publisher about what grain of paper you want to publish your books in, and he can only talk at 1 o'clock Pacific time because he's in Canada and blah blah blah. It's hard. But if you really want to do it goes back to the thing we were talking about production assistance and all of that other stuff. If you really want to do it, you'll do the extra thing. You'll do the you'll deal with the BS.
Did you see the Five Heartbeats documentary?
I did not, but I'm aware of it.
Man, because when you were talking about having to cater to their sensibilities, like they cover how they wanted them to take out the scene with the where they was putting the song together with a piece of paper, and they wanted to take out the scene where they get saved at the end. I'm like, those are the two most monumental scenes, like, and the white folk wanted to take them out. Like, oh my gosh. And so it's just so interesting that in this space where we're trying to create diversity and they're claiming to want to do diversity,
But
but
everybody
it
has
still
a
has to be, they still have to get it, which
but
that
everybody
doesn't
has
create
a
diversity.
but everybody is a different they've used that word. That's a charged word, that diversity. Everybody has a different definition for what that word means. I've heard someone say, I swear when I say this, that diversity doesn't mean color, it means thoughts. That people who think differently. So you still don't really have to get different types of people in the room physically. We can have the same construct of people in the room that have always been in the room. They ain't got to look like me and you. We just have to think different. So it's a way of still keeping the status quo. And nothing really has to change. And by and large, I won't say nothing has changed because you have people, we wouldn't be able to have this conversation if nothing had changed. But I really think if more were to change, we wouldn't have this conversation in the same way.
Because I think another key word in the general, society is a culture fit. It's like they want people that are just like them, so that instead of value add, it's culture fit. And it's like, if you don't like this, or like, or if you don't, if you've never watched Star Wars, if you don't watch anime, if you don't wear a tie or something like that, it's like you can shun people. And so it's all these keywords. So I've heard you talk a lot about your journey. What would you say is the importance of networking and making genuine connections with people in your career?
Finding your tribe, finding your tribe and finding your voice. I don't think Hollywood buys writers. I think it buys voices. If I was trying to staff on a TV show, I've had more than one studio showrunner, whatever, read scripts from me and say, when I read your script, I wanted to meet the guy that wrote that script because I heard a voice. I heard somebody in there and I wanted to meet that person. And I've heard it across the board. Whatever it is that I do, you know, I didn't create the Boondocks. I didn't create a lot of the shows that you reference. But there's a thing in there where people say, I heard you. I know you did that. I know you did that. And they can read this and whatever. And if you read my specs and if you read different things and if you read stuff, you will hear Rodney throughout Wu-Tang and Winning Time and this, that, whatever. Philadelphia, there's a Rodney thing. That's a voice. And that's marketable. That's a commodity. That's something I can sell. Those are wares. Just like in a Western, I can take that to town and I can sell it. As a writer, if you can develop a voice, you're not just another person who is proficient. You're not just another person who can dot I's, cross T's, write good sentences. And so all of those things are important. But what's coming from you? There's a thing that you have, and I'm pointing to you. There's a thing that you have that I don't have that makes you unique. There's a thing that makes you valuable in a way that I could never do in a million years. It's just as valuable as me. If you could write that and focus on that instead of focusing on me, I'm not talking about you personally, I'm just saying the metaphorical you, then you'll find that. And if you can cultivate that thing. You can, who knows what you could do? It doesn't mean you can't study my work or anybody else's work to get there. I'm a huge Stephen King fan. I've read everything that Stephen King has written. And I use that as a template to say, oh, he did it this way. He tried that. Oh, maybe I'll try this and da 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 da. But then I may do it this way because that way speaks to me. But I'm still using the example of him as a foundation of a thing, as an example. Same way he may have looked at Richard Matheson, the same way this person may have looked at this person. There's nothing new under the sun, but then there's another thing that we may bring to the party that's different. And the more I think that you can cultivate you and bring something unique to it, you know, Jordan Peele, I look at as like Alfred Hitchcock. You know, he has his own Hitchcockian way. In the third act, he goes to a place I would never go as a writer. Instinctively, there's a place he's going, I don't know where he's going to go, you know? And there's rabbits in us. There's the rabbits in the thing, and the people are walking on the mountain, and they're going to go, and I don't know. And, you know, God bless them. And it's brilliant. It's so brilliant. I may not understand it, but I respect it every time. And that's the thing that he does. And Rodney does a different thing. And there's nothing wrong. That doesn't make my way of doing it any less valuable. And there are people who are like my thing, and people like his thing, and every once in a while they'll like both of our things. And so, to anybody out there that wants to be a writer, develop your thing.
So do you think the voice gets lost in trying to mimic
Of
other
course, yes.
people?
Yes. That's where it's like hip hop. When somebody's successful, and then next week you got 10 people trying to sound like the person that was the one with the hit thing. You know, you got 10 mumble rappers or auto-tune people or whatever the hot thing is. Everybody's trying to be the next hot thing. It's like that's what people do, I think, across the board because they think that's the thing that's going to. I remember when Black Panther hit and everybody was saying, all right, we're looking for the next hot black superhero movie. And I don't see none of them get made. And I think here, the tried and true test is to stick with history. And history is the person who is really, really good at what they do and is consistent, has a better odds at making it through and getting to be able to talk to you.
I can see it like the more layman person sometimes doesn't care about different specificities in like content, but I can tell like sometimes I can tell John Boyega and like the dude from For Life. You could tell who studied Denzel, and like the dude from For Life, I just was like, I can't, like, you're literally Denzel, like you even walk like him. And so it kind of throws me off for people to study others and then not take their version of it. And it's and some people like the layman like viewer will be like, oh yeah, I see that they've studied Denzel and they don't care. But it's like, it's just kind of off-putting to me. Like, why do you want to be exactly like someone else? They can just get Denzel. So I see like John Boyega hides it more, but I can still see like some way he holds his mouth. You could tell he studied
Yes.
Denzel. What did it mean to you to get the key to the to your city, your hometown of Annapolis, and have like June 24th established as your day last year?
It was very moving. I was surprised. It was great to see a lot of people I hadn't seen in maybe 30 years. I wish my grandmother had been there to be able to see it, because she probably thought I would have gotten the key to my cell at the detention center. I will say this again, for a place that was a slave port, for people who the first place that they saw from when they left their homelands was Annapolis, Maryland. For a brother to be getting the key to the city from the mayor of said city, even if it's symbolic,
Yeah.
was symbolic in and of itself of a degree of progress. And
Yeah.
so for that in and of itself, I was honored, I was flattered. It made me want to do more. I'm trying my best to connect. There are some challenges in the community that I wrestle with, because like in all communities where that lack resources, you're going to have problems. And I try to do what I can, but then again, you can't fix systemic issues are systemic issues. No one person, you could be a billionaire, you can't come in and you can't fix, because there's thinking that's behind it as well. And you can't change thinking. But I love my people and I appreciate my people, and I hope to continue to do more.
As a veteran in the entertainment industry, what have you decided is your purpose in regards to blackness and black professionals in entertainment?
I hope, and I don't know if this answers your question, but I hope that we can continue to move the needle. If you look at where we started, because this wasn't built for us, we weren't, the industry wasn't built for you to ask me that question. The industry wasn't built for one day somebody to ask me that question. In the industry, we were just sort of, little apostrophes along the way. They went that away, sir. That was what we were in movies. Then you
The
had
little
guys.
asterisk.
Yeah, we were that. It's like we were. Then you had Oscar Meshaw and guys like that who came along and sort of being the outliers who started to make things. And they had to contend with, all of a sudden you had the Stepin Fetchits and the Amos and Andys and all of those guys that came in, and then it continued to evolve. And then all of a sudden you had your Sidney Poitiers and those guys and your Blaxploitations, and you look at the evolution, how it keeps going and keeps going and keeps going. And so when you ask me that question, I hope that in the present day we continue to, whether we're talking about movies, TV shows, comic books, all of that stuff, we're able to continue to move the needle to a place of us being able to present ourselves and all of our humanity in an honest way, which I try to do in my books. If you look at Killadelphia and Nita Hoss and those things that I have full control over, I try to present them as human beings. I try to present their problems in a human way. I try to present the resolutions in human ways. I put them on par with anything that you would see in the Big Two or any other comic book company that would be on the world, in the world. I don't. I try to with dignity and respect. In my other work, I try to do that based upon the boundaries that are created within that I'm working with in the same way. I hope that as time goes on, for however long I have left to be able to continue to do this, to continue to do that and move the needle, so that in whatever this little period of time that I've spent, that I've been here, to be able to contribute in a way that moved the needle in a positive way and contributed. That's all. I've just seen it change so much from when I first got into it to now, from like the late 90s, early 2000s to today. It's just evolved. And I don't even think I noticed how much it evolved until like really the last 5 years of how much it's really, really changed. And I don't know where we are within it, because sometimes you think, man, we're in a great spot. And then there's a step backwards and then there's a step forward. It's always weird to where we are. You have a great moment. You get like a woman king, or you'll get something where you'll see something that, a moment, but then you want to see like this traction. And then to where you get on a regular basis, you're getting some stuff that's coming out, and not just comedies. Nothing wrong with comedy. I love comedy. Started comedies, love comedies, but just like, a myriad of things on a regular basis so that they don't feel like they're exceptions to the rule, to where you get a healthy dose of horror films, dramas, this, you know, that these things are happening on a regular basis. And they just come as a natural part of the Hollywood diet.
Mm-hmm.
And we're consuming them, and that they're, I think this is my last thing. And then I hope that we get to a place too where we can develop resumes, where the younger people who are coming into the business can build resumes.
Yeah.
Not the people who immediately shoot up and become superstars, but the people who are coming up in the business are able to get at studios and just build resumes. And I think, you know, with what Ava DuVernay is doing at Array and giving people jobs, I think that's great.
Yeah.
But I would love to see studios doing that across the board, just allowing people not just to get a staff gig here or there, and then once they get out of that staff gig position, you know, push them to the side, but really making it a commitment for people to be able to just build careers. That's all.
Mm-hmm. To kind of go along with that, what do you hope Black writers and creators are doing in this current landscape with access to technology and social media that you wish you could have done coming up?
Making things. I mean, if I had a cell phone that you could make a movie with and a computer that you could do anything with, it's like, I remember there's a place in Hollywood, it used to be, I don't know if it's still there, called Hollywood Book and Poster.
Mm-hmm.
And when I wanted to read scripts, I used to love a show called Homicide: Life on the Street. It was my favorite mm-hmm. TV show, and The X-Files.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was learning how to write, even though I'm still learning how to write, I would want to read scripts of shows that I like. So I would go there, and for $15, I could buy a script
mm-hmm.
of episodes. So I would go there and order a script, and the next day they would print it for me, and I would drive over to Hollywood, and I could go pick it up. Today, I push a button, and I can download scripts for days of anything that I ever wanted or could ever dream of.
Yeah.
And when people ask me sometimes, hey, where do you get scripts from? I actually get frustrated. Because I'm like, all you got to do, you got this computer in front of you. Even this phone, your cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
Your cell phone is a computer. You can, any information that you want is at your fingertips. And I just think that it's a great time to be able mm-hmm. to just make things.
Yeah. It's like sometimes it's, as somebody who gets reached out to, it's like, did you type it in Google first? Like, I understand that I can answer your question.
Mad, like, they get mad. Again, like my kids, like, well, I got, my daughter said this one time when I'm telling them horror stories, but I used to have a little garbage company, like
uh-huh.
I was a production assistant because I didn't make enough money as a PA.
Mm-hmm.
I had a garbage company where after, when I wasn't a PA on the show, sometimes when I was, I would charge $1.50 a bag at the end of the night for the catering people to dump their bags when they were done with the production.
Mm-hmm.
So I could make an extra $100, $250 at night finding a dumpster.
Mm-hmm.
And I would tell my kids these stories, like, this is work ethic. This is what you do. And they were like, Daddy, the beauty of that story is you did it so we didn't have to. Like slavery. Like, you know, somehow, because the slaves did it, we don't have to be slaves anymore because
right.
you were a slave. And I'm like, that's not what you were supposed to take from it. You were supposed to take work ethic. And it's like, at a certain point, I'm like, all right, just take the credit card, go get what you want.
Just go on. And that was their plan all along.
It's like, and one of them wants to be a basketball wife. It's just, none of this is good. None of this is good.
And it's possible. Like, that's the horrible part. It's more possible.
Oh, my God. You know, she just comes in. I need one more ab, Daddy. I need one more ab. And then Devin Booker is going to marry me. I'm like, okay. All right. I don't need to go to college. I'm ready. Okay. All right. Good luck with that one.
Right.
Good luck with that one. You're the only one with that plan. Okay.
So my last question, if someone was producing a documentary about you, what things would you want them to highlight about your life outside of your work and entertainment?
Oh, Lord, how hard I've made it on myself. Don't, as a cautionary tale, don't do this. Don't eat more, eat better, sleep better, drink more water. Do not do. This is what you don't do. This could have been so much easier. if you did not do these things. Don't be so temperamental. Be more patient. Go into therapy a decade before this. Don't get with this woman. Everything would be what not to do. Okay? Again, you're talking to me because of the 20 times people said yes. We could be on here for another 2 hours for all of the things you should not do that Rodney did. Don't say this joke. It's not worth the laugh that you're going to get. Don't say that. Truly, though, in all sincerity, it would be all of the things of what not to do. It wouldn't be any, that would be the advice. It would really
learn from my mistakes.
Learn from my mistakes, how to better take. It's almost like, it's weird, in a weird way, I'm absolutely true. When I worked for, when I was working on vinyl, Martin Scorsese, who was like 85 now, something like that. And you see it with Francis Ford Coppola, who's in his 80s now as well, that when you take care of yourself, you can work until you're, if you're good at this, you can have longevity in this business, but it is an endurance sport.
Yeah.
And I'm in my 50s. And the older I get, you get tired, like mentally. And you see how old becomes because it wears you down, and the hours and life in general, that you wouldn't say that this isn't cardio per se, but the better you can take care of your body and your mind, the better you function. And writing is about clarity and focus.
Yeah.
The better I can focus. That has to do with your interpersonal relationships. If you got a lot of drama in your life, the harder it is to write.
Right.
Because you're too busy fending off the drama. So that means, who do you associate with? If you have a better tribe around you and people who support you, because you're always going to be wrestling with yourself. I'm always dealing with me. There's nothing you can do to make life perfect. If you have supportive people around you, you're going to have a better quality of life, which is going to help you be more focused with your life. All of this is, you would think, has nothing to do with writing whatsoever, and it has everything to do with life. And if I had known this back in 90, whatever, when I started this, I would be, I'd probably have everything. I would have an island. I would have so many, wouldn't have a plane, I'd have a helicopter. I would have so many things, but yes, I would be eating vegetables. I'd be drinking water like you. I would have so much. It would be better. But no, I make dumb decisions. I love sugar. You know, I keep making decisions that defy longevity. And there you go.
Luckily, I figured out how to, like, because I try not to keep stuff in my house, but like, I've learned if I do have something in my house, hide it in a cabinet. Because if I put it out in front, I'm going to eat it. So sometimes I'll be in the cabinet like, oh, I still got some candy that I brought.
Wait till you get old. See, that's young people tricks. When you get older, you get to a point where I ain't going through all this. Give me these M&Ms. You just reach. I don't even want to get up. I'm like a supervillain. I can reach out and grab anything that I want right now and destroy the world. I can get M&Ms, I can get lasers, I can get anything that I want and just not move. And that's how I've created a life for myself. Right now, you're tricking yourself. You're preparing yourself to be like me. Don't do it. You're better than that. I'm warning you right now. This is the documentary. This is your question right now. You're better than me. Have a better life.
Yes, I will listen to your wise words.
Thank you.
So, lastly, you have a project, Blackula, Return of the King, coming out. Let people know how to get it, and where can people follow you on social media?
Right now, you can pre-order Blackula on, Blackula's right here at my feet. Blackula, Return of the King, right now. You can get it on Amazon. Pre-ordered on Amazon right now. You can get it at your local comic book shop. There are not enough of those in the world right now. Right now, those are the two ways that you can get it. You can find me at the Rodney Barnes on Instagram and on Twitter primarily. You don't want to go on Facebook. Only old people on Facebook. You don't want to go on Facebook.
Because I'm old. Oh, Facebook is
Yeah.
my platform.
I do. That's where I go to talk to people and have, like, that's relationships on Facebook. You argue with people. People get mad at me on Facebook. Instagram and Twitter, people get mad on Twitter, but people can have relationship anger with you on Facebook. You can make up. Like, on Twitter, you just get angry with people. On Facebook, you can get angry and make up on Facebook. But that's where you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at the Rodney Barnes, and you can get Blackula on Amazon and your local comic shop.
I want to thank you for allowing me to highlight you. I really appreciate it.
Likewise, I enjoy talking to you.
And to everyone out there, I want you to like so I know it's real. Comment and tell me how you feel. Subscribe to Seal the Deal and sign up for post notifications to show your zeal. And I'll see you in the next video. Peace.